This is They Create Worlds, episode 208, Two Dunes, The Battle for Arrakis. One, two, three,
four. If anybody wants to find me.
The podcast They Create Worlds, known as TCW, home of the research. The research controls the historical narrative. Whoever controls TCW controls the research. The Emperor has proposed a challenge to each of the hosts.
The host that produces the most research shall control TCW. There are no set territories and no rules of engagement.
But yes, we're here. We are They Create World. I'm Jeffrey and the historian Alex, and I are here to talk about a book, a game, a movie. We don't even know what it is anymore, but we're talking about Dune.
Yes. Right. Know that it is the year 2024. And video game history is controlled by, I don't know. I got nothing. But yes, welcome to They Create Worlds and our examination of a couple of games that went by the name of Dune. You'd think that one was a sequel to the other, since one is Dune and the other is Dune 2, but that is most certainly not the case. We're going to explore how the heck something like that happens, because it's a pretty interesting story. Shout out to Ethan Johnson, friend of the show, who had the idea of doing this episode right now, because there was this Dune Part 2 movie thing that just kind of came out that I hear was kind of a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably one of the better adaptations of Dune to the big or small screen.
Well, yeah, definitely. The best of them, in my opinion. That's something that's had its own pretty convoluted and crazy history over the years. But yeah, it made sense at this time to kind of revisit these games. They're both very interesting games. They're both classics in their own right, quite frankly. Played both of them as a kid, enjoyed both of them as a kid. Yeah, we're not going to do like completely thorough making ofs of both of them because this is going to be a single episode. Truly. Truly. Don't look at me like that, Jeffrey.
We're putting down 10 to 1 odds here on this one's kids. 10 to 1 odds on this one.
But just kind of wanted to give a little background on how and why some Dune video games got made at the beginning of the 1990s. And like I said, why there's a Dune and a Dune 2 that have absolutely nothing to do with one another.
Okay, do we go in order, Dune 1, then Dune 2, or do I just go and make a whole bunch of palaces and send the Fremen on a rampaging rampage?
That's a pretty good strategy if you're playing the Atreides, I suppose. But no, we got to start a little bit by kind of setting up what Dune is, really. I mean, what is Dune? Does anyone really know? So, of course, Dune is a classic science fiction novel by Frank Herbert, published in 1965, though it was serialized before that, across 1963 to 1965. It's notable as being the first science fiction book to win both the Hugo and the Nebula Awards, though that is not as impressive a groundbreaking feat as it sounds, because it actually won the very first Nebula Award. So there was literally nothing that could have won the Hugo and Nebula Awards in the same year before it, because one of those awards didn't exist. Frank Herbert was a journalist, and he had been assigned to cover a story up in Oregon. Oregon has a lot of sand dunes along the coast. For those that don't know, I mean, a sand dune is not just a really tall hill of sand. Sand dunes are actually almost living, moving things. They're kind of like glaciers made of sand in a way. They shift around and move this way and that due to weather forces. People up in Oregon wanted to be able to use a bit more of the land along the coast here, and so they were actually starting to plant various grasses and whatnot to try to anchor the dunes in place, something that has had both positive and negative effect on that part of Oregon since then. But he was fascinated by these dunes and by the kind of ecology behind this and the idea of mankind trying to control nature and transform nature in this way. He also had a lot of interest in the Middle East and Middle Eastern cultures. This kind of combined together, essentially, into this novel that he wrote, Dune. Dune is a book that has come in at times for criticism for being Orientalist, white supremacist, eugenicist, you name it, all the badists. While some of those criticisms may have a little bit of validity in today's world, just because we do think of the world differently today than we did in 1965, most of those criticisms miss the point because, yes, all of those things are there, but they're there because Frank Herbert wants us to know they're bad. Like, he doesn't actually support these things, but a lot of people see the hero Paul Atreides is going on kind of the typical hero's journey, a la Joseph Campbell, and that he's therefore supposed to be this laudatory figure. You know, he comes to this world, his family is betrayed, he's cast out into the desert, but he finds his way and becomes a messiah and avenges his family and becomes emperor, and the galaxy lives happily ever after in decades of jihad. But no.
Wait. Something there didn't add up there.
Yes, it unleashes this jihad across the universe. But the thing is, Paul Atreides is not meant to be a heroic figure. He's not meant to be the hero of the hero's journey. It's a warning. It's actually very cynical about religion and very cynical about organized religion and the ways that organized religion basically deceive the people for their own gain and want people to wait around for messiahs to save them. And then, you know, this is a messiah that actually shows up and it's a bad time for everybody because the galaxy gets a jihad and the Fremen basically get to lose their identity and their way of life and get kind of consumed in all of this. People didn't kind of get that point after the first book, so Herbert wrote the second book, Dune Messiah, basically for all of these people who didn't realize what was going on. It's like, okay, you didn't realize that I was saying a messiah is bad, so now I'm going to write a sequel novel about the fall of Paul Atreides that is much more hitting you over the head with, like, messiahs are bad, okay? Just stop. I think it's interesting. Some people don't get it, and they'll be like, but you know, it's a white savior, and that's bad, and you know, he's also property of a genetic breeding program, so it's eugenics, and that's bad. And it's like, yes, Frank Herbert knows that's all bad. That's why he wrote the book. So, you know, that's a slight tangent because none of that really plays into the mechanics of either of the Dune games that we're going to be talking about today, but you know. Tangents, it's a thing we do at They Create Worlds. Now, one piece of criticism that the novel comes in for that is very true is that the novel is very homophobic. That's because Frank Herbert himself was very homophobic, and that's not speculation. One of his sons came out as gay, and Frank Herbert basically disowned him. The main villain of the piece, the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen, is made vile in the book in every way Frank Herbert can think of to make him vile, so that there's like a giant neon sign over his head saying, "Hey, villain, we got a villain here." One of the things that he deliberately does to make him very villainous and disgusting is to make him fat, gross, and homosexual. That's a little bit unfortunate in a modern context, but the rest of it actually still holds up quite well because he's actually going against those tropes rather than supporting them. Dune became a big hit, obviously. As is often the case with big hits, people really wanted to film this thing. It was considered basically unfilmable at the time. I mean, we really weren't ready to film it until just about now for real. Because, I mean, when Denis Villeneuve did these movies, that's really the first time that we've had the technology to do all of this justice on a budget that wouldn't bankrupt a small nation. There have been several adaptations of varying degrees of goodness. There were several other attempts to try to mount a film adaptation aside from that. That never got off the ground. We won't get into all of that because this is not an episode on the entire history of the Dune franchise, but it is important to note that because the reason that we're going to get to a Dune game at all is because there was a movie in 1984.
For some reason, people like to do merchandising. Oh, we're doing a movie. Let's do a tie-in of a video game.
Sure, and that would have happened if not for the crash. Parker Brothers, which of course we did a whole episode on, did get the rights to make a Dune game, and they were going to make a Dune game and an adventure game for the Atari 2600. The prototype of that actually surfaced a couple of years ago. It was never released because there was a crash going on in 1984. It was a bad time. Then the movie also did its own version of a crash, and that was not a good time either. I bring all of that up because this led to a very unsettled rights situation for doing a Dune adaptation, because the David Lynch movie is released in 1984. It's a disaster. Some of the ideas in it are interesting. Some of them I'm not a fan of. Cough, weirding modules, cough, cough. But regardless of my own personal tastes, it was way too confusing for a general audience. They literally handed out a card at the movie theater to everyone who saw it, trying to explain some of the basic concepts of the universe. Literally, you had homework, you had reading material you had to do before you could enjoy the movie if you had not actually read the novel. Then they had, you know, not one, but essentially two long expositionary prologues. First, the Princess Irulan's talking head coming up and giving you some basic information about the universe that we were riffing on a little bit at the start of the episode. And then a giant first scene, which is basically all exposition explaining what's about to happen. Dune is a dense book. It's huge. It's almost 900 pages. That includes appendices. So not quite all of that is narrative material, but it's huge, and it's complicated, and it has all of these different factions, and it has plots within plots, a phrase that is used all the time within the book itself to describe what's going on. It's very Byzantine. There's all of these strange cultures, and David Lynch was told that he had to basically, you know, cram all of this into like 2 hours, just over 2 hours. So there was no way for this, regardless of some of David Lynch's eccentricities and whether he was really fully up to making this kind of blockbuster, which is not his usual fare. I mean, he's a genius filmmaker, but he's not known as a blockbuster filmmaker, it's fair to say. So whether he was in over his head or making some weird creative choices or not, there was no way to tell that story in 2 hours. There are bootlegs out there that add in a bunch of deleted scenes because he originally filmed like a 4-hour movie. That improves the flow a little bit if you have all of those deleted scenes in, but even then, it's just a mess. It was a box office bomb. It had been produced by the famed Italian producer Dino De Laurentiis. De Laurentiis's company went bankrupt, largely as a result of the failure of the movie. Went bankrupt in 1985, and then Frank Herbert died in 1986. There is no direct evidence that the movie killed him, but one does have to wonder. Nah, just kidding. Between company bankruptcies and deaths and all of this stuff, the rights to Dune were kind of in limbo. And of course, you know, the rights had been given to Parker Brothers to do video games, and Parker Brothers enters into trouble because of the crash, and this new Kenner Parker company is formed in 85. So, like, nobody's really quite sure where the rights are at this point, who one needs to go to get rights. No Dune game comes out at the time of the movie, and it's questionable that anyone's going to be able to get a Dune game out ever, at least in the near future, just because it's impossible to see where the right situation was. So the likelihood of a Dune game getting made in the early 90s, for a variety of reasons, was actually pretty darn slim. And it really only happened because there was one massive, massive fan of the books that very desperately wanted to make video game adaptations of them. And that was the head of Virgin Games' North American office, one Martin Alper. Our story really begins with Martin. To understand this story, we do have to give a very brief They deserve their own episode sometime. But a very brief overview of the company Virgin Games, because this thing is a multi-tentacled, multi-headed beast of corporate shenanigans. That weird structure that it has is critical to understanding how these two games that are unrelated to each other end up both coming out around the same time and one being given a sequel number to the other, even though they are in no way related. The Virgin Games that exist at the beginning of the 1990s is really a smashing together of two companies, both of which were founded in 1983. One of those is Virgin Games, which was just a small British computer game publisher that was founded as part of the Virgin Group. Richard Branson was always keen to get his company into areas of new media. Computer games came along. He decided it would be cool if the Virgin Group had a video game company. Hired a guy named Nick Alexander, who established the company, started fielding submissions from all the bedroom coders across the country of Britain, and started publishing games in the same way that all of these little British publishers were doing. At the same time, there was another company called Mastertronic that was starting up, and this company was the brainchild of the aforementioned Martin Alper, as well as two other gentlemen, Frank Herman and Alan Sharam. They were actually in the video cassette business. When this whole computer game thing started in Britain, this whole kind of ZX Spectrum scene that was really gathering steam by 83, 84, they saw an immense opportunity to make a profit here because the British video game industry was an entirely cassette-driven industry. It was tape drives. They didn't go for those expensive fancy floppy disks as we've talked about a few times before on the show. The typical computer game was going for like £8, £9, £10, but the medium was cassette. Cassettes are dirt cheap, less than a pound. It was like 30 pence per tape or 50 pence per tape or something to duplicate them. Then they were being sold for £8, £9, £10. When these three gentlemen learned about that, they thought to themselves, this is nuts. That's almost gouging the poor public. Now, of course, they're thinking about the actual commodity. They're not thinking about all of the hours that the poor bedroom coder has put into making this thing, et cetera, et cetera. They're just looking at that real cost analysis between the cassette is this much to create and then is being marked up by this much to be sold into the public. So they thought, surely there's a place for cheaper software than this. And if we could break into that market, we could make a mint. And they had just bought, I believe, a tape duplication facility. So they had the means to enter into this business. And so they decided to inaugurate a new kind of paradigm in the British industry, which was budget software. So what they did is they started making deals with a lot of different bedroom coders because there was this real bedroom coder movement in the UK. You had so many teenagers and college students and even some older people than that that were just puttering along on their ZX Spectrums or their BBC Micros or whatever at home. And then you had these kind of small cottage industry publishers that would go around to computer fairs and put ads in magazines and whatnot and say, hey, you want to publish a game, you know, send us something and we may publish if it's good. So Mastertronic got into this same business and they started soliciting from all over the place. But instead of charging the typical £8, £9, £10, they were going to do games for £5, for £3, maybe even £2. The way they were going to make that low price work for them is basically by putting out massive, massive volume. So they were in the video cassette business. They were in the retail business. They understood how what's called jobbing works. A jobber is a particular kind of person in the retail industry who will come in with a rack of things. They're usually called rack jobbers. They'll go to store, hey, Mr. Store, I have got this rack of fabulous products. And what I would like to do is I would like to put this rack of fabulous products right over here by your cash register, where the general public can do an impulse buy on this thing that I have here. we will take complete care of maintaining this rack. You don't have to worry about ordering things to stock this rack. You don't have to worry about maintaining this rack. You don't have to do anything. We'll do all the work, and then we will split the fabulous profits with you. I know I've made this analogy before in past episodes, but if you've ever shopped in a Walmart or a Target or a similar store, and you see those bargain DVD racks right up front where there's like $5 DVDs or whatever on this display separate from the regular electronics department, those are maintained by rack jobbers. Like Walmart and Target don't actually stock those. They don't choose what goes in them. They actually contract that out to a company that takes care of all of that, and then they split the profits. So they created a cassette game kiosk, a Mastertronic rack or kiosk, and started peddling it around everywhere, not just the W.H. Smiths of the world, where games in Britain were traditionally sold, but even in places like gas stations and any place that had a register and a little space for a rack next to a register. They put out their games in far greater volume than anyone else really in the industry, and it was that mass volume that made up for the fact that they were selling them for such a cheap price. This was something that was ripe for taking off in Britain at the time, because we've also talked about this before. Britain was in the throes of a piracy crisis. Because, you know, floppy disks are really easy to pirate and copy, but cassette tapes make that look like rocket science. Cassettes are really easy to duplicate.
You can do it with a boombox, pretty much. A double cassette boombox. Record from one, play in the other.
Yeah, because there's no difference, no practical difference between the cassette tapes that you're using to load a computer program and the cassette tapes that you're using to play your favorite music. Now, obviously, the type of data that has been encoded on that magnetic medium is very different. If you put a computer game cassette in a tape deck and hit the play button, you're just going to get a bunch of screeching noise.
Alien sounds.
Exactly. But the way the data is copied and transferred from one tape to another is exactly the same. On about 1983, the first cheap dual tape decks were coming around in Britain, put out by the company Amstrad, which of course becomes very big in the British computer game scene in a few years as well. This is completely unrelated to that because they're just in the stereo equipment scene. But for the first time, the general public in Britain has pretty easy access to a dual tape deck, which is the one thing you do need to pirate. If you just have a single cassette recorder, that's not going to do it very easily for you. I mean, you could jury-rig these things together, but, you know,
you buy two tape decks, you take the headphone jack of one and put it as the line in or mic in on the other, and you get it in there, you get a copy, but the problem there you get into sort of like with us in audio, where if you have enough wired going around doing this, that, and the other thing, you introduce jitter and extra sounds and degradation, and then it just eventually you have a copy of a copy of a copy that is practically unplayable at that point because the quality is so bad. Effectively, bit rot.
Exactly. But now that these dual tape decks are readily available and people are buying these into homes, there's a massive upswing in the pirating of games, especially because, as I said, these games were like £10. Which is more than $10, because the pound is worth more than the dollar. There were a lot of them coming out because this was a big cottage industry, and a lot of them were just plain bad. And I don't just mean that they weren't an enjoyable time. I mean, they would be bug-filled. Some of them would be unplayable, literally unfinishable. There were also quality games going out. I'm not saying the whole thing was a wasteland, but the problem was if you were the average British kid and you're walking into your local computer shop or your local W.H. Smith or Boots and you're seeing this wall of software, you probably have barely managed to scrape together enough money to buy one $9.99 game, $8.99 game. You've got this wall of software. The magazine industry is getting started a little bit with reviews and whatnot, but it's only getting started at this point because the boom has just really fully begun. And, of course, there's no internet, so you have nothing to go on except the cover art to try and maybe, you know, if you've heard of a particular company or and liked one of their games you played before, maybe that can give you a little more guidance. But you have nothing but that to go on to figure out how to spend your hard-won 7, 8, 9, 10 pounds that you won't see again for weeks upon weeks. That's a pretty fraught process, and when so many of the software is dodgy in this early period, that's a doubly fraught process. So there was a real incentive for the consumer to pirate, because they couldn't get all the games they wanted at that price, and they couldn't even be sure that the games that they did get at that price were actually going to be any good.
We really go into all of this in very in-depth, and I will put into the show notes the British 8-Bit Computer Hardware and Software episode we did, along with the ZX Spectrum episode.
Absolutely. The great thing about the budget software market is it made it easier to buy a bunch of games, and it took away a lot of the impetus to pirate. You'll always have some pirates, but a lot of piracy is driven by ease of supply and demand. And, you know, I'll speak about my own piracy that hopefully the statute of limitations have run out on. No, I'm not admitting it. This is all hypothetical. I admit nothing publicly, Jeffrey. You know, looking at the 2000s, the 2000s was a time when broadband internet was becoming widespread, and it was becoming easier to acquire digital material like movies or television shows over the internet, but the only way still to get most of that stuff was to either get a cable subscription and watch it that way, or go buy the movie or rent the movie out and about on a piece-by-piece basis. If you didn't want to have a cable subscription for whatever reason, because it had gotten ridiculously expensive and there were television shows one wanted to watch, I'm not saying me, but one wanted to watch, then it was much better to just be able to have a bunch of them available to you on the internet and watch that way. And since the companies hadn't done that, that meant raising the black flag at the Pirate Bay and taking care of business. Nowadays, you have all of these streaming services, and yes, all of these streaming services cost money, and one could still raise the black flag and go to the Pirate Bay, which somehow manages to domain hop all over the world and continue to be in existence today, despite the fact that everybody knows it's there and everybody in media wants it gone. That's still an option today, but people that I know, I shouldn't name any names, people that I know don't pirate nearly as much as they did 10 years ago, because even though the streaming services do cost some money, there's a convenience there, and there's enough convenience there for the money that it counterbalances the inconvenience of doing the pirating. For a lot of people, that's just a long tangential way of saying that for a lot of people, for all but the most hardcore pirates, it's usually a disconnect between the cost or availability of a service and the expectation of the consumer is what creates that hole. You know, when Kazaa became really big and Napster, all the other big music downloading stuff, it's because the record industry was really dumb and had to be dragged kicking and screaming into digital music by Apple because they didn't want to give up the massive profit margins that they got from selling physical media and forcing you to buy an entire album of tracks when really all you wanted was your two or three favorites. They got greedy, and the result was out-of-control piracy. Then iTunes came along, and while, of course, there's still piracy in the music industry, it's not out of control in the same way it was before that. Going on a lot of tangents. This is about Dune, did we say? Dune is the topic of conversation in this episode?
Last I checked, it was. But to continue your piracy thing, it doesn't have to rely on just digital media like we're talking about here or the more modern stuff. This goes on in every other aspect where you have a high volume something or a high price something, and you have people who need that something at a whatever price. The one that immediately comes to mind is Alex and I were once strolling through Venice, Italy. There were these wonderful people with boom boxes and nice rugs and carpet selling bags and clothing and other little knickknacks. I think I even saw a Mickey Mouse at some point. Then all of a sudden, there was some sort of unheard or unseen signal by me, and all of them disappeared. They grabbed all their stuff and decided that it was time for lunch. I can get around lunch.
It was very impressive to watch how quickly all of these handbags and clothing disappeared. Then, of course, about 2 minutes later, here come the two cops walking their beat along the street.
Slowly. Very slowly.
Very slowly, that's right. They didn't want to catch anybody. That's paperwork.
They'll only catch the dumb ones. The really, really dumb ones.
Exactly. So the dance continues. Yeah, that was pretty wild to watch play out in real time.
The point being that this kind of piracy stuff does go on and has gone on since time immemorial because something costs way too much. Someone else can do it cheaper. That can be a knockoff or a cheap or a copy or whatever. Might not be as good, but it's cheaper and it makes the person who wants the thing feel good because they can buy it.
Exactly. Mastertronic, by introducing budget software, took away some of the impetus for piracy. Obviously, that doesn't mean piracy goes away, and it doesn't mean that there weren't still tons of people pirating Mastertronic games, but it did mean that they had more legitimate consumers. So them adopting this model just completely transformed the British computer game industry. Not necessarily for the better, quite frankly, because it meant that you got a flood of low-cost computer programs, which meant that, of course, a lot of them were also of pretty low quality. It was kind of a race to the bottom in some ways. But nonetheless, it filled an important niche, and Mastertronic became one of the biggest players in the industry. After doing this for a couple of years, though, the rest of the industry got wise and caught up. Everyone started reducing the price of their software, and budget software became the new mainstream way of doing software in Britain. You still had a few more expensive releases, but basically everyone had to at least get down to £5, if not even lower. While Mastertronic had some success in that world, once they started losing their monopoly in that world, they really needed to look for other methods to continue having a decent revenue stream. The other thing that happened is not only did other publishers start to emulate them, but their best suppliers were like, wait a minute, we're making all of these games. These games are selling hundreds of thousands of units, which they were. Their biggest hits could sell up to 300,000 units, which are huge figures on computer platforms at the time. Why are we making these games and then giving them to these guys and making a pittance while they're selling hundreds of thousands of units and making a fortune? So some of their best suppliers of software went off and made their own budget publishing companies, the most significant of these being Codemasters, which persisted as a publisher for decades after that. They still exist today. They're not a publisher anymore, I don't think. But they were still a publisher into this century. They had to find other ways of making money. So they started trying to become a more upmarket publisher. They bought Melbourne House, which was an Australian-British hybrid kind of publisher. They were starting to release more full-price game, higher-quality game releases, and they set up an American branch to break into the lucrative console market. They kind of drew straws, the founders, and Martin Alper drew the short straw, and so he was the one that was sent over to the United States to get that whole thing set up. We talk about a lot of that in our recent episode at the time of this recording on The Seventh Guest, because, of course, The Seventh Guest came out of this American branch of Mastertronic, which became the American branch of Virgin Games. So they have Martin Alper over in the United States, and he basically can do whatever he wants over there to get them established. We have Frank Herman and Alan Sharam, but especially Frank Herman, still over here in Britain overseeing the company there. Then they get the opportunity of a lifetime as they're trying to figure out these different things that they want to do to expand the business since they no longer have the monopoly in the budget software, budget game field. They get this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity dropped into their laps as Sega is entering the European market. Sega is very keen to make some inroads there because, of course, in Japan, they're already completely obliterated by Nintendo. In the United States, it's still early going, 1986-1987 time frame, but it's already not looking good. Nintendo's not focused on Europe at all, and so Sega really wants to try to get into those European markets and offset some of its lack of success in other places. They contract with local companies in several of the major markets. Mastertronic is the company that ends up being the distributor of the Master System in the United Kingdom. Then Sega fails to get units into Europe in sufficient quantities for any of the companies that have made these deals with them to make any money off of it, to turn a profit. They just don't have the supply. All of their European partners get very upset and pull out of their relationships with Sega, with the exception of Mastertronic. Mastertronic uses this opportunity to say, hey, I see that everyone is abandoning you. Why don't you let us do Master System distribution throughout all of Europe, not just Britain? Sega was like, okay, sure, whatever. Getting this distribution set up across multiple markets that are all pretty darn different from each other, Europe definitely not a monolithic market, was going to take a huge outlay of capital. So this is what led them into the arms of Richard Branson and his Virgin Games. Virgin Games was still just kind of a small player in the computer game scene, but of course the Virgin Group was a huge, huge media company, media and other things, company in the United Kingdom. So there was a lot of capital there. So they went to Virgin and said, hey, we have this opportunity to distribute this system all over Europe, but we need some money to do that. You guys have money. We have this lucrative distribution contract. Maybe we can do business together. And so basically, Virgin bought out Mastertronic to create what was called for a time Virgin Mastertronic, solely so that they could get into this Sega console distribution thing. Now you really have multiple layers of management all over the place, often very independent of each other, because that's kind of how Richard Branson runs his groups. He's got all of these loosely affiliated companies. You have Nick Alexander, who's still in charge of Virgin Games, so is kind of the guy that's in charge of the whole show. But then you still have Frank Herman, who's very much in charge of Mastertronic and is going to be very much in charge of the Sega distribution business and still running a lot of the day-to-day of the Mastertronic company. You have Martin Alper, who's off in the United States in what is now Virgin's U.S. office. He's pretty autonomous over there. He technically has to answer to people back in Britain, but, you know, they're kind of all equals, and then they all kind of answer into one Robert Devereaux, who oversees that part of Richard Branson's business, Richard Branson being very hands-off on this and not really caring at all. So you have basically three different executives at the top that can almost do anything they want. You have the head of Virgin Games, Nick Alexander, the head of Mastertronic, Frank Herman, and the head of Virgin in the U.S., Martin Alper, who can basically do whatever they want. And so we've been doing this long-winded setup here basically to set up this weird management structure that is going to be critical to the story that we're about to tell. So Martin Alper's a really big fan of Dune. He's a big sci-fi aficionado, and he really likes Dune. And he liked the movie, too, I think. So he wanted to make a Dune game. It was his dream to do that. Part of the reason that he was sent over to the United States was to acquire franchises that could be exploited by Virgin on consoles. They were kind of getting a lot of the leavings, a lot of the licenses they were getting were kind of weird licenses like the 7-Up mascot Spot or McDonald's. Now, some of the games that they made were very good because they had truly top-tier programming and artistic talent, as we talked about some in our 7th guest episode as well. So some of the games were actually way better than they deserved to be, considering that they were based on licenses like the 7-Up Spot. But, you know, these weren't exactly prestige licenses. Dune was much more of a prestige license, but probably the only reason that nobody was making a Dune game, because everything with any level of cachet was getting made into a video game in the late 80s, early 90s. All sorts of ridiculous properties. I mean, the fact that McDonald's and Cool Spot are like game properties just tells you that. And, you know, that doesn't even begin to account for the Noid from Domino's also getting his own game. It was a ridiculous time. I lived through it. Jeffrey and I both lived through it. It was a ridiculous time.
We might still be going to therapy over it.
So really the only reason I think that the Dune license was available to a company like Virgin, which was not as well established in the United States and was mostly just picking up the tiny little leavings of licenses that nobody else would bother with, quite frankly. Now they do get the Disney license a little bit later, and that is a big deal license. But in this early time period when they're still just establishing themselves, they're kind of relegated to these D-list licenses. I think the only reason that the Dune license is even available is no one can figure out who actually owns a license. The book licensing is a mess with Frank Herbert's death. I don't know much about what happened with his estate. So I don't know if there were legal battles going on over the rights to the books or if just the estate at that time was very hesitant to do any licensing. My guess is that there was probably some legal tussle because obviously there's all sorts of Dune books now written after Frank Herbert's death. But that process didn't start until the 90s. Do yourself a favor and don't read them. If you take one thing, if you take just one thing away from this episode, don't read any Dune books that don't have Frank Herbert's name on them. It's unfortunate. But there's been a lot of exploitation of the Dune literary universe in more recent years, still going on to this day, is the point I'm making, and that wasn't going on at that time. So I have to imagine that there was some rights confusion over the book rights, though I don't know that for certain. And the movie rights were just a mess because Dino De Laurentiis was bankrupt. So who has them? Dino probably doesn't. Universal was the distributor. Does Universal have the rights? Then on top of that, you had the fact that rights to the video games had been licensed out to Parker Brothers, which of course never ended up making a game. But then the question comes, okay, does Parker Brothers, or rather its successor, the Kenner Parker Group, have the rights to that? Or did those rights revert? Or where the heck are the rights? So it was a really hard mess to disentangle, and quite frankly, while the books were beloved, the movie had flopped, the reputation of the property wasn't the greatest at the moment, and the rights were so hard to untangle that I think no video game or computer game publisher really cared to go through all the effort it would take to figure out how to get the rights. Except for Martin Alper, because he was a big fan. And even he, you know, according to some of the interviews that have been given around these games, even he was telling people around him that, you know, yeah, we're trying to do Dune, we're trying to get the rights, but, you know, I don't know that we're going to be able to get the rights. I mean, even he was really pessimistic that this would actually work out, but he really wanted to do it. So he persevered over the course of a couple of years, I think. I'm pretty sure he started kind of looking into this like in 1988 or so, and it took a while. But he finally figured out that Universal Studios, Universal Pictures, which had distributed the film, owned now the rights to the film. They didn't own book rights, obviously. That's with the estate or the publisher, book publisher, whoever. But they have the film rights after Dino De Laurentiis went bankrupt. So he's finally able to make a deal with Universal for the video game rights to make an adaptation based on the movie. Doesn't have rights to make an adaptation based on the books, the 6 books written by Frank Herbert, but he does have the rights to make a game based on the film. So then the question becomes, okay, like a dog chasing a car, it's like, okay, we've caught it, now what? At the time, according to Stephen Clark Wilson, who was the head of product development at Virgin, according to Stephen Clark Wilson, at this time, Martin Alper was really keen on turning Virgin into the next Sierra Online. He was really enamored with Sierra Online graphical adventures. So this is kind of what he wanted to move the company into on computer platforms. He basically wanted an adventure game based on Dune. So now, of course, they needed to find a developer. They were building up their in-house staff in the United States, as we talk about in our 7th guest episode, but they're really all focused on the console market, and this is at least initially not going to be a console game, and it's going to be an adventure game, which is kind of outside of the wheelhouse of the programmers and designers working on all of the platformers and whatnot that they're doing in the console space. So they're going to need to go to an outside company. The outside company that they end up connecting with is a small French company by the name of, we'd call it Cryo in English, but I suppose it's pronounced like Cryo Interactive. In French, Cryo Interactive. Cryo Interactive is another story company that has a bit of a convoluted history that we're not going to go into all the details of here, because we are doing this in one episode, Jeffrey. It's going to happen. We're closer to the end of the story than you think. I know you're thinking, oh my God, we've been recording for almost an hour, and we're just now getting to the part where they're going to make a game about Dune. All the prologue is actually the complex part of the story, so it's actually going to start moving pretty quickly here. Well, quickly for us.
Okay, fine. I'll update the odds to 5-1, just because you asked.
Aw. So, Cryo Interactive was a new developer founded by a gentleman by the name of Philippe Ulrich, who was a struggling musician back in 1980 when he was strolling along the Champs-Élysées in Paris and ended up discovering an electronics shop that had a ZX80 computer on display. He became fascinated by this thing and fell in love with computing. Funny story, and you cannot make this up. The name of the computer shop that he saw the ZX80 in on the Champs-Élysées? Dune.
Really?
Not kidding.
Why would you name a computer shop Dune?
Yeah, it probably sounds exotic. It's the French. They're weird sometimes. It's okay.
Come now to Dune, where we have all the fine, wonderful games that you want. Games full of sand. Games full of worms. Games full of spice, just to make it all hit home.
Yeah, but it's just one of those little funny life coincidences that the company that ends up making Dune was founded by a guy who bought his first computer in a computer store, in an electronics store named Dune. But there you have it. So he got involved in this kind of nascent hobbyist computer market here in France at the beginning of the 80s, and then partnered with a gentleman by the name of Emmanuel Vieux. They formed a company called Air Informatique in 1983. Air Informatique is really not that remarkable of a company overall. It's just another one of these, you know, one amongst many of these little companies. But they do manage to have a pretty decent-sized hit in 1985 with a pinball game by the name of Macadam Bumper, which kind of gets them a little bit of cachet in the industry. As they continue to grow and expand, they don't really want to be involved kind of on the business side. That's not really what they're about. They're about making the games. So in 1987, they sell out to one of France's larger publishers, Infogrames, which, of course, we have done a whole two-episode retrospective of.
Extravaganza.
Extravaganza back in the day. This one will not be two episodes. It's during this time that their subsidiary, they're still under the name Air Informatique, but they're a subsidiary now of Infogrames, that they create their most significant game. And it's an adventure game by the name of Captain Blood. Now, this isn't a game that made any kind of impact in the United States across the Atlantic, so I would not expect most of our American listeners to know what the heck that is. I certainly, before I started researching video game history, had no idea what the heck that was. It's a game that is interesting in concept, but really not great in execution. It's a sci-fi story, exploring the galaxy kind of story. There's some pretty gnarly lore behind it, pretty complex lore behind it that I'm not going to get into here. Basically, you're flying around the galaxy and you're having to try to figure out how to communicate with this alien race who communicates through essentially just pictographs. There's a lot of flying around, there's some action sequences, there's some really obtuse communication sequences, and you're basically trying to, due to reasons, there are a bunch of clones of you running around now, and you have to destroy them all and kind of remake yourself, rejoin yourself into one person. I don't know, it's French, it's weird. So the gameplay is not the greatest, but the presentation is really interesting, like the aesthetic of it, the graphics of it. They got Jean-Michel Jarre to do some of the music for it, very famous French composer. So it has a lot of these very interesting aesthetic touches on top of a game that isn't much of a game. However, it was released fairly early in the 16-bit home computer life cycle. Came out in 1987 for the Atari ST. The Atari ST and the Amiga, that 16-bit generation, were still kind of just getting spun up in the United Kingdom and Europe. So it came out pretty early in the 16-bit life cycle in Europe. And because it was very impressive visually and aurally on a relatively new advanced platform, people kind of overlooked the fact that the gameplay sucked because they were blown away by all of the aesthetic of it. So it was a very, very big hit. It caused Ulrich himself to, as he was doing promotion for the game, to quantify this kind of French aesthetic as what he called the French touch, which is this idea that French games don't necessarily have as sophisticated or as well-developed a gameplay as games made, say, in the United States or maybe in the United Kingdom, but aesthetically, they have this certain je ne sais quoi that American companies, English world companies, just can't replicate. They're very artistic, but not necessarily the best games.
I can sort of see that. I'm skipping through some of the video of it.
Yeah.
The layout of the consoles and stuff is really interesting. How they do the pictograph stuff is interesting. A lot of the artwork is nice.
Yeah.
I've seen that with other media from France, too. Like, one of my really weird tangent for me, but a movie that I liked when I was a kid, and I only saw it in its entirety later on in my life, was a movie called Light Years, which has to do with this alien race that has time travel, alien future versions of themselves coming back to steal younger versions of themselves to empower them in the future. And so this guy got to break a time loop and all this other strange stuff. It's artistically really beautiful. The plot's a little weird, but it's still interesting, and I can see where you're coming from there.
Yeah, and this is kind of the stereotype that the English-speaking world kind of has of France generally, not just in the realm of computer games. I think of the Simpsons episode with Gabbo, where Gabbo comes along and the Krusty the Clown show is in the doldrums as children's programming. Krusty loses the Itchy and Scratchy show, which goes over to the Gabbo show and tries to substitute in a French cartoon called Worker and Parasite. You know, we'll put some of this in the show notes. It's aesthetically very interesting looking and, you know, completely like nonsensical as a narrative. That's the joke. And of course, they're playing on the stereotypical perception of French media at the time, which is that it can look and sound stunning, but it doesn't always make a lot of sense. And as you said, Captain Blood, you know, to look at it, a lot of it looks very interesting, but the gameplay is very shallow. It's very shallow, repetitive, obtuse, and generally unrewarding. Once you get past all the cool aesthetic vibe, there's actually not a lot of game there, but it sold very well despite that and became one of the most well-known French games of the time. Unfortunately, as we talk about in our Infogrames episode, at about this same time, for a variety of reasons, Infogrames was teetering on the edge of bankruptcy and looked like it may not even exist as a company for much longer. Again, won't go into all the details. Someday we may do an episode on Ulrich and Air Informatique and all of that. I don't know. But basically, a lot of the Air Informatique people end up extricating themselves from Infogrames, including Ulrich, and come together to found a new company, Cryo Interactive. It's kind of a really loose collective, almost, of programmers and artists and musicians that are looking to just get back to the business of making games without being burdened by all of the problems going on with Infogrames. As they're looking for publishers, one of the first publishers that they end up going to is Virgin, because Virgin is a company with a great international reach, so they have a French office. Of course, they're based in Britain as their main office. So they get together with the Virgin people and pitch them on some game ideas. Alper, who really wants to do this kind of adventure game of Dune, and of course, Ulrich and the ex-Air Informatique people are known for their adventure game, Captain Blood, they come to an agreement, basically, that Cryo will make this Dune game. So, yeah, that's how things get going. And probably, I think we're talking about 1989 here. Yeah, I think 1989 is when all of this gets settled. Even though Alper's the one that kind of put this together, he's not going to be their primary point of contact through most of this. They have two primary contacts. One of those is Jean-Marchal Lefranc, who was the head of the French office of Virgin Loisir, who was kind of the one that was paying the bills for them, you know, kind of since they're all located in France. And then there was a producer in Britain by the name of David Bishop that was actually going to be in charge of the creation of the game. The creation of this game started out in a very unusual way. Because Dune is so dense, because Dune is so hard to encapsulate a full story on, and because there had already been one attempt to encapsulate the story of Dune, the David Lynch movie that went spectacularly badly, they actually didn't start out making the game. This was at Virgin's direction. Virgin didn't want them to just get started on programming a game. They told them, go away and figure out what the plot of this thing is actually going to be before we get involved in game mechanics. So they went off, and for 6 months, they did nothing but storyboarding of what the plot was going to be like and what the flow of the game was going to be like. Not writing a single line of code, just storyboarding. Throughout this process, things got pretty fraught between Cryo and their producer at Virgin, David Bishop. A lot of this story comes from a French book that is a history of the general video game industry. It's not just about the history of video games in France, but has a lot of material on the French industry because it's written by a French author. L'Histoire du Jeu Vidéo is the name of the book, The History of Video Games in English. A lot of our information in our Infogrames episodes came from this book, and a lot of the information for this story also comes from that book. So that book, Philippe Ulrich is one of the through lines of the entire book. So like the author interviewed Ulrich, and he really focused on Ulrich at various parts of the book. So that book is told from the very sympathetic perspective of the Frenchman, of Ulrich and Cryo Interactive. So to hear it tell in that book, David Bishop just hated the Cryo people, didn't like them at all, was out to get them, and was sabotaging the project at every step, saying, no, this is bad. No, do this over. No, this is terrible. Ah, I hate you all. I hate the French. Rah. I think that's probably an unfair characterization. I think this is an example of the author getting a little bit too close to their subject, Philippe Ulrich, and not taking a nuanced approach. Near as I can tell from more neutral stories, is that the problem that was being perceived by David Bishop is the exact problem that Captain Blood had, the exact problem that the French Touch had. Aesthetically, it was looking very interesting. Gameplay-wise, not that anything had been coded yet, but the proposed gameplay looked like an absolute mess. They came up with this idea of combining an adventure game narrative with a resource management strategy game. Spoiler alert, when we get to the actual game, I think the final implementation actually works pretty well. But what we have here is not the final implementation. What we have here is a very early version of this, and it's a god-awful mess, according to Bishop and the people at Virgin. Obviously, I've not seen these storyboards. I don't know. But the people at Virgin were not impressed with the gameplay choices that were being made by the Cryo team. And that kind of tracks with what we've said about Captain Blood and what we've said about the French Touch. So that's pretty believable. I don't think Bishop hated them or was out to get them. It sounds to me like he just had really legitimate concerns as to the gameplay of this project. They're going back and forth on this for months, trying to lock down a design, trying to lock down something that everyone's going to be happy with. Finally, after all of this struggle, on September 19th, 1990, Cryo gets a fax from the London office that we're not going to make this Dune game with you. We do not believe that the concept is strong enough, and we are canceling your game. That should have been the end of it. Their game was literally canceled by the publisher. But as I said, Virgin Games has this really weird, decentralized operating structure where you have a lot of people that are kind of masters of their own realm that don't always have a lot of oversight from other people, even the people that are technically ranked above them in the company. basically, they got this fax, and then they also immediately got notification from Frank Herman, who we may recall is not the head of Virgin Games, but was one of the heads of Mastertronic and is the person that's primarily responsible for the Sega distribution business. Frank Herman, on top of that, just says, don't worry about it. Just keep working on the game and we'll figure it out. He instructs the head of Virgin Loisir, again, not the head office, but, you know, even though Cryo is working with Martin Alper in America and David Bishop in Britain, they're technically attached to the French branch of the company that is actually paying their bills, even though nobody in the French office is responsible for the creation of this game. They're the ones that are cutting the checks. So Frank Herman just says, keep working on it. And he tells Jean-Marchal Lefranc, the head of Virgin Loisir, keep paying them. So even though Virgin has canceled the game, Virgin has said, no more work, we're done. You lose, you get nothing. Good day, sir. Frank Herman is just like, whatever. We'll keep paying you, it doesn't matter.
I want the game.
Yeah, but it's not his call. It's not his game.
That doesn't matter.
It's been canceled by the company.
It wasn't canceled by the right part of the company.
But it was. Frank Herman should not be doing this. Jean-Marchal Lefranc should not be doing this. They're basically just like, we don't care what you say. We're going to keep funding this and we're going to keep it a secret from everybody. I mean, they're not embezzling or anything. I do think at the end of the day, Frank Herman is spending money that he's authorized to spend. It's not like they're embezzling or doing anything illegal. But it's just, there's a lot of autonomy amongst the various people that run the various branches of this very distributed group that is Virgin. So there's a lot of wiggle room in there to just keep working on something, whether you're supposed to be or not, and to keep paying them for it.
That sounds like a recipe for the entire company to go bankrupt really bad.
Well, I mean, you know, they're not around today. Let's put it that way. The game is done. The game is dusted. And Martin Alper still needs a Dune game. At this time, as I said, you know, Martin Alper is working on a lot of different initiatives in the United States. You know, he's doing the whole console thing. He's securing the licenses. They're doing the Genesis stuff. But he's also continuing with his goal of becoming the next kind of Sierra. He's really into these adventure games. So because of that, he has been working with a company that has a revolutionary icon-driven adventure game interface by the name of Westwood Studios. Little company that we might have heard of here, that at the time is working on the game Legends of Kyrandia, which is a point-and-click adventure game. He's really enamored with this game, which is published by Virgin. He's really enamored with the company, Westwood Studios, and so he goes to them and says, hey, I have the Dune license, so want to make a game based on Dune? And they were like, yeah, sure, that sounds fun. They were fans of Dune. You know, Lewis Castle and Brett Sperry, the founders of the company, they were fans of Dune. They thought that that was a fantastic idea. Now, it's interesting because you have the Virgin people and you have the Westwood people. The head of development, I mentioned his name earlier, at Virgin in the United States at this time was one Dr. Stephen Clark Wilson. Both Stephen Clark Wilson and the people at Westwood, particularly Brett Sperry, who led the project, Lewis Castle wasn't really involved in it, both kind of in parallel, like, take credit for a lot of the basic ideas of the game. It's hard to say who actually decided between the two of them that this should be a strategy game. It's possible that maybe Stephen Clark Wilson was like, you should do a strategy game. And then Brett Sperry was like, that's a good idea. It could be that they both independently came to that. It could be one of them is not lying. I'm not accusing anyone of lying, but it could be one of them is misremembering the sequence of events. Who knows? But Stephen Clark Wilson says that he was really impressed by the real-time strategy game Herzog Zwei, a Japanese game that is retroactively been considered like one of the first real-time strategy games, even though that didn't exist as a category at the time. You know, told them that, like, you should do a game, kind of a strategy game in real time, kind of like this Herzog Zwei thing. Brett Sperry and Joe Bostick, who was the lead programmer, they don't acknowledge any influence from Virgin on the choice of game to make. So I don't know. We only have the stories. We can only report the stories. What Brett Sperry says is that he thought that a war game would be interesting because of the struggle over the planet. And he was really at this time kind of focused in on how war games had become very niche, and there was no reason for them to be so niche. Like, he felt he could fix them. Westwood had done a lot of work with SSI, Strategic Simulations Incorporated. They'd done some D&D games for them, AD&D games. SSI, of course, was primarily a war game company, so he would have conversations with the people at SSI about war games. He says that, you know, he was speaking to Chuck Krogel a lot, who was the head of development at SSI, and talking about how, I don't understand why the war game has fallen by the wayside like this. And, you know, Chuck Krogel's like, you know, people consider them slow and outdated and clunky now. And, you know, they're moving on to faster, more exciting genres. I mean, we're talking about a period of time here, just a couple of years before Doom, not to be confused with Dune, is about to come out. You know, we're about to this period where the fast adrenaline pumping game are really starting to take over. Wing Commander's already come out. It's all about the cinematic and the action and less about the strategy. And Chuck Krogel's like, people are just moving on. And Brett Sperry is like, yeah, but I don't think it's got to be that way. I think it's possible to do a strategy or a war game that hews to this current aesthetic. And in forming that opinion, he was primarily influenced by three games, or three things, rather. Only two of them are games. Each of them provided a little piece of this puzzle. One of these was a TurboGrafx-16 game called Military Madness. Now, Military Madness was just a traditional turn-based hex map war game. It wasn't breaking ground in that area, but it had great graphics, much better graphics than you normally saw in a war game, because, of course, it was being made by a console company. It was not being made for a computer platform. It also had a streamlined interface over your typical war game. The people at Westwood were playing, they were fans of strategy games and war games, so they were playing a lot of Military Madness around the office, and these things very much impressed Brett Sperry. The other game was Populous, the progenitor of the god game genre. Because, of course, in Populous, you build up all of these religious followers, you're a god. You're shaping the terrain, building structures, and growing a legion of followers who then you send through a bunch of mouse clicks to go on their own jihad, not unlike the jihad unleashed by Paul Moadib at the end of Dune, to conquer the map. So you're moving these units around with the mouse. It's a little more abstract. It's not directly point and click, you go here kind of thing, but it's another game with a mouse interface. It's in real time, and you're herding these units around. Then just the Mac interface itself, the GUI operating environment with easy point and click and all of this, was something that he felt should be applied to computer games in a way that it just wasn't being done at the time. Everything was still largely text commands or really clunky menus, drop-down menus and whatnot, and he figured that there was a better way forward. He wanted to take all of these kind of ideas that he had for presentation and interface and kind of prove that the war game was still viable in this modern environment, despite the doom and gloom he was getting from Chuck Krogel at SSI. So that's why, according to Brett Sperry, that the Westwood folks decided that their Dune game would be a war game. They had also played Herzog Zwei, and they were somewhat influenced by Herzog Zwei as well, but they really downplay, on the Westwood side, they really downplay the influence of that game, though they do acknowledge that they were playing it, that they enjoyed it, and that they certainly took some influence from it. They set about creating this war game that takes place in real time and is defined by using mouse clicks to move your units around the map. So they start working on this, they get this set up, they get some of the basic gameplay elements in place, and they quickly realize that there is a problem.
I know why there's a problem.
Why is there a problem?
There's a traitor among us.
Oh no.
And we're questioning everybody, including you.
Oh god.
So first, I have to ask you, what kind of podcast is this?
Music?
Execute the traitor!
Yes, the copy protection scheme, which was rather easily defeated, which made the game pretty easy to pirate if one were so inclined. Certainly not us. Statute of limitations are up on that one. I did apologize. I've interviewed Lewis Castle, the co-founder of Westwood. He wasn't really involved in the development of Dune 2, but I mean, he's the co-founder of the company. I did apologize to him in our interview.
What did he say?
I don't remember, but he's a nice guy, so I'm sure he said nice things. This was many years ago, but yes, I did get to apologize to someone at Westwood. Anyway, I digress. So there was something that became clear very early on was not working, and that's just that it was over too fast. He was still thinking in terms of a traditional war game at this point, where you have your starting forces, they're arrayed on this map, and then you move around those forces and attack the enemy and try to achieve victory. Well, because everything was in real time, that was over in a matter of minutes. It wasn't much of a game at that point. That's when the final important influence enters the picture, and that is civilization. Because civilization is not in real time, obviously, but what civilization has is a system of resource acquisition leading to both the building of military might and the researching of new technologies to improve the array of options you have available. So basically, he took this real-time combat thing that he had come up with, or they came up with, Sperry, Bostick, and the rest, and then added a layer of civilization on top of that by making you have to harvest the spice so you can build the structures so that you can produce the units and get to the fun effing part of the game.
Which is where you run out of spice entirely, you're in a perpetual stalemate with your enemy, and if you have enough palaces, you can just send an army of Fremen or an army of randomly hitting nukes and just wait with your sandwich and your tea until the nukes eventually hit everything and you win. The Ordos, on the other hand, because they take over units with this weird little thing, I could never beat.
Indeed. Then, of course, they had technological progression in there as well. This essentially becomes a form of tech tree. You have to build this before you can build that, and there's some upgrades you can research. It's almost a tech tree progression as well. So they basically introduce a dose of civilization into their real-time combat game, and that's how they get Dune Battle for Arrakis. Not Dune 2 Battle for Arrakis, Dune Battle for Arrakis. Then there are changes at Virgin.
Changes.
Basically, this entire Sega distribution business, as the Mega Drive, as the Genesis is called in Europe and everywhere, really, except the United States, as the Mega Drive has really taken off, this Genesis business has become the tail wagging the dog. So a decision is made mutually between Sega and Virgin that Sega is going to take over the direct distribution of its hardware and software in Europe. So Sega basically buys the Mastertronic portion of Virgin Mastertronic that is responsible for all of this Sega console stuff and transforms it into Sega Europe. So Nick Alexander leaves Virgin Games to become the head of Sega Europe. Frank Herman leaves to become the new head of the UK arm of Sega Europe. There's a defection of a lot of other people as well at this time, including Jean-Marshall Lefranc at Virgin Loisir. So the people that have been keeping this kind of clandestine cryo development going, Frank Herman and Jean-Marshall Lefranc, leave the company and are replaced by new people. These new people are going through the books and are basically like, what the heck is this? Wasn't this canceled?
No, it was not.
Why are we still paying for this?
What is going on here? We have discovered dissension and heresy in the ranks.
So the jig is up because their benefactors have left the company due to this whole Sega Europe thing being ripped out of Virgin. The new head of Virgin Loisir, Christian Brechtot, after figuring out what's going on here, doing a routine audit, basically says to the people at Cryo, okay, this wasn't supposed to be happening, but it has happened. So go to London, talk to the people there, and you can make your case for your game to keep going, but I'm not making a decision here. Like, you will get no support from me.
If you win, we'll work with it. If you lose, you fall on your own sword. You have no support. We disavow any knowledge.
Exactly. So at this point, things have actually changed. I mean, they've continued working on the game, and the game has actually developed pretty well. First of all, aesthetically, it's amazing. Graphically, it's amazing. The characters are very interesting looking. They have this great desert flying sequences where you're flying your ornithopter over the desert and the terrain just flows in a really interesting way. And it's visually stunning for a game at the time. Their kind of resident in-house musician, Stefan Peek, has been working on the score, and the music is fantastically moody and evocative. So, like, the French touch is in full force here. That side of it is really impressive.
There's voice acting.
Yeah, well, I don't know that they have voice acting at this point, but yes. Well, in fact, I'm sure they don't, because it came out on floppy first before it came out on CD. It's got all the aesthetics going on, but the thing is, the gameplay has actually, during this period of secret development, started to come together much better. So all of that haranguing by David Bishop that they couldn't stand about how this isn't fitting well together, the interface sucks, this sucks, that sucks, despite the fact that they didn't like all of that, clearly having David Bishop provide this kind of feedback has helped break through this traditional French touch kind of barrier on gameplay. And they actually have a game that works pretty well at this point. It is interesting. I found it fascinating as a kid. I beat it. I played it through to the end. You have this linear narrative that you're following that is more adventure gamey. There's not really much in the way of puzzles to it. But you're going around, you're meeting people, you're going through dialogue trees, you're discovering new rooms in the palace, you're discovering new sieges out in the desert, you're doing all of this stuff. But then on top of that, another game starts where you're gaining the loyalty of these sieges, and then you're assigning the Fremen in these sieges to various tasks, spice harvesting, military, or later on ecology, because you can start greenifying the dune just like the Fremen want to do in the books. You're outfitting them with equipment like harvesters and carryalls for spice harvesting, Chris knives and las guns, and because this is a movie adaptation, the dreaded weirding module that I find completely ridiculous, to your military units. You have to balance your resources because the Emperor has a spice quota every month or whatever it is, because the game has a time cycle going on in it, so time passes as you're doing things in the game. So you have to meet the Emperor's spice quota every month, or he sends in the Sadakar and it's all over. Like, if you're real near to a victory in the game, you have just a tiny amount of time before the Sadakar wipes out everything. So you could still technically pull off a victory if you're already close to a victory, but once the Sadakar come, it's basically over. You've lost the game. So you have to harvest enough spice to keep the Emperor happy, and his demands go up over time. Every time he wants more spice. He's a greedy man, the Emperor of the universe. So you've got that pressure, but then you also have to gain complete control of the planet. You have to conquer all of the Harkonnen forts on the planet, because in this version, unlike in the movie and the books, the Atreides and the Harkonnen are both vying to be the masters of Dune at the same time in a competition. So you have to take out all the Harkonnen forts and then take out the main Harkonnen base, where you discover, shock, the Emperor was behind this all along, and, you know, then you win. So you have to have your military forces, and they have to be outfitted strongly enough to be able to take these forts, but you have to keep up spice production, and you have to make sure you take out all the forts before the Emperor demands so much spice that you can no longer meet the quotas, because each siege also has an amount of spice that is available there. So eventually, there's no way to not run out of spice, because the spice is not a regenerative resource in this world. In the real Dune universe, in the books, it is a regenerating resource, because it's actually made through a biological process involving sandworms. So it's constantly being replenished, but there's a finite amount of spice in the game. So eventually, no matter what, you will not be able to meet the Emperor's demands, because even if you put everything towards spice production, there will eventually be no spice left. So you have to balance these competing needs of these three types of things, the ecology, the military, and the spice harvesting, and then defeat the Harkonnen. It's actually really interesting. The story is not bad. The linear path you take is not bad. And then the resource management side of it is interesting. The game does take place in real time. It's not a real-time strategy game. You're not like pointing and clicking and controlling individual units, but everything is happening in real time. So when you give orders for your armies to march to a fort, they slowly move there in real time. All combat's abstracted. You don't actually engage in combat. But everyone's moving around in real time. Spice is harvested in real time. The emperor is demanding, is cut periodically. It moves in real time. It's a real-time strategy game in a way. But it's more like, I think the best analog really in some ways would be the later concept of grand strategy. The games of Paradox Interactive like Europa Universalis and Hearts of Iron, it's not nearly as complex as those. That's the kind of real-time game it is. It's kind of a grand strategy game with an adventure game plot thrown on top, because why not? It's actually working. It's actually working pretty well. So over the course of that presentation, they're impressed enough to let them keep going for another 5 weeks. They basically say, okay, you've got the germ of something good here, but it's still got a confusing design. It's still got that French confusion in it. Go away for 5 weeks, streamline the game in these ways to make the bloody thing playable. And if we feel you have a playable game by July here in 1991, we will publish your game. They go away for 5 weeks, they clean it up, and Virgin's happy. So they're like, fine, we'll release this. Virgin is a company that was always kind of strapped for cash. So their philosophy was always, as soon as a game was ready, or as Stephen Clark Wilson said cheekily in one recollection, sometimes even before a game was ready, they would immediately publish it. By virtue of the fact that they'd been working on the game longer, Dune by Cryo Interactive was ready for publication a little bit before Dune Battle for Arrakis from Westwood Studios was ready to go. One day, you know, the Virgin people come to Westwood and are like, oh, hi, guys. By the way, we're about to publish a Dune game, so we can't call yours Dune anymore. You're going to be Dune 2. The Westwood people were not happy about this. It wasn't really a sequel. I mean, generally speaking, historically, sequels never sell as well as first entries in any series. I mean, that's just general economics. So I'm sure they didn't like to be tarred with the sequel idea from that perspective. But I'm sure they also didn't like being tarred with the sequel idea because the games had nothing in common. They were not part of a common narrative. In fact, Dune Battle for Arrakis is actually set thousands of years before the books. They deliberately set it in a different time frame because they didn't want to run into any adaptation problems. So there are no characters. I mean, they use the houses Atreides and Harkonnen, and then Ordos, which I think technically appears in some footnote somewhere in some supplementary source, but is not actually a fleshed out participant in any of the Dune saga at all. They've taken the Atreides and the Harkonnen and a few other basic concepts like the Fremen, but it has none of the characters from the book or the movie. It has none of the plot from the book or the movie. It's just, hey, let's all make war and gain control of Arrakis. You know, I'm sure they were also worried that people would play Dune and be, oh, I'll continue the story in Dune 2. And then we'd be like, what the hell is this? This isn't continuing the story that I just played. This makes no sense. And of course, a completely different type of gameplay. So they were not happy to be called Dune 2, but they really had no choice. It was released a few months later as Dune 2, The Battle for Arrakis. That's why we have a Dune and a Dune 2 that have nothing to do with each other. They're both quite successful in their own right. I think overall Dune 2 is probably a little more successful. Don't have final sales figures for Cryo's Dune, but you know, Dune 2 sold a couple 100,000 units, which was a big deal at the time. And of course, it also happened to pioneer an entirely new genre of games. So, you know, that didn't hurt either. Cryo's Dune had some pretty good sales figures too, but I do believe a lot of that was probably artificial and due to OEM bundling. I know the reason that I played Dune is our mutual friend John Lewis, when his family got a CD-ROM drive for their computer, Dune was one of the games that was bundled with the CD-ROM drive. That's how I played that one. And John Lewis and I actually played that together and we beat it. We found a nice little exploit for the game. The balancing of the different tasks can be kind of tricky. To be able to have enough military might to overcome the forts, which are pretty darn hard to overcome, you need a lot of forces. But if you put too many forces into your military, then you don't have enough people harvesting spice, and then the emperor gets mad at you before your big military can actually conquer all of these forts. I'm sure that we probably didn't figure out the most optimal strategies for this. I mean, I don't think, generally speaking, people consider that it was an impossible game to beat or anything. But we found an exploit, a perfectly legitimate exploit. I'm not talking about hacking or using trainers or something like that. But the game does primarily play out in real time. But there's one very important exception to this. Because there is an adventure game plot on top of this. So you're meeting with people, you're having dialogues, you're having interactions, and this also plays into the progression of the game in addition to the ticking clock. While the game is always going in real time, Paul in this game discovers that he has these advanced abilities when he goes out into the desert at night to get infused with the spice all around him, and then has a vision that the emperor has contacted the palace. This is one of the key plot points. This is the emperor calling for the first time to say, okay, guys, you're set up. Now we have a quota system. Chop, chop. Well, because this is specifically tied to this plot moment, and this plot moment only activates if you go out into the desert to trigger this cutscene, the emperor will not start asking for spice until you trigger this cutscene. At this point in the game, you don't have access to all the sieges, so you mine spice around Fremen sieges. You discover the sieges over the course of the story of the game. So at this point, you don't have all the sieges discovered, and it's impossible to discover all the sieges because there are many sieges you can't go to until after you trigger this cutscene with the emperor. However, you have already discovered several sieges at this point, and you do have spice harvesting equipment. So what we did after a couple of unsuccessful attempts where we just couldn't get things done in time, this time we realized that this cutscene triggering was what started this, and so we mined every last drop of spice out of every single siege that we already had access to before we sent Paul out into the desert to have his vision. What this meant is we had a big stockpile of spice right up front, and we had drained a lot of our land of all of its spice, which meant that we could devote more of our Fremen to military service without impacting our spice production because we'd already done a large amount of our spice production. So that playthrough, it actually was pretty easy at that point. We beat it without much trouble. So it was an exploit, but it was a legal exploit. That's my Dune story, but I do think a lot of the sales that Dune had were OEM bundling because it was released on CD-ROM, and then it was also released on the Sega CD later as well, so they did get some console sales out of it. So it was successful, but its legacy, of course, was not as long-lasting as Dune 2, which only got made because Dune was canceled. It's possible Alper might have gone to them anyway at some point, quite frankly, because he was anxious to exploit the Dune license. They would have certainly probably made other Dune games at some point. But the only reason he went to them at that time is because he had canceled another Dune game, and then other people in the company were like, don't worry about it. That is the story, in a single episode, I might add, of why there was a Dune and Dune 2 that came out within months of each other and had absolutely nothing to do with each other.
But why did one have copy protection and the other didn't?
Who knows?
Okay, well, now that we get to go back onto the Spacing Guild ship in order to go back to Earth, continue our little epic here.
Yes, indeed. We can safely arrive back to Earth now, and I think it's time that we did another company history. We used to do a lot of company histories. We don't do as many company histories anymore because we've already done the histories of a lot of companies. But now it is time to fill an important plot hole in the TCW universe, in the TCW Extended Universe.
And that is?
We may recall that not in our last live stream, but in the live stream before that, I started talking about a non-existent accolade episode.
Oh, yes. The non-existent accolade episode, because obviously, for the live stream, we had alternate universe Alex.
Exactly. So I figure it's about time we plugged that plot hole and did a look at accolade. I have a lot of good sources on the company. I've interviewed one of the two co-founders. I've interviewed three of the five people that served as CEO of the company during its relatively short lifespan. Got a lot of insights into what was going on there. This will probably be a two-parter. There's literally not enough material to be a three-parter. I imagine it will be a two-parter. But we'll take a look at Accolade, which is a really interesting company. It was kind of the next evolution of the Activision model, as it was founded by a couple of Activision people. Had a few hits, had a few long-running franchises, had a lot of difficulties, made a disastrous foray into console gaming, and ended up not surviving into the new millennium, being gobbled up by Infogrames. But there's some interesting games in there, some interesting political stuff going on in there, and we kind of owe it to the listeners, since we kind of said it existed when it didn't, to provide them an episode or two on the computer game company, Accolade.
It's just like light years. Things from the future affect the past, and the past becomes the future.
As it was written.
So we're going to explore the mysteries of Accolade next time on They Create Worlds. Check out our show notes at podcast.theycreateworlds.com, where we have linked to some of the things that we discussed in this and other episodes. You can check out Alex's video game history blog at videogamehistorian.wordpress.com. Alex's book, They Create Worlds, The Story of the People and Companies That Shaped the Video Game Industry, Volume 1, can now be ordered through COC Press and at major online retailers. Email us at feedback@theycreateworlds.com. Please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/theycreateworlds. Please get the word out by leaving a review on your favorite podcasting service. Intro music is Airplane Mode by Josh Woodward, found at joshwoodward.com/airplane mode, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Outro music is Bacterial Love by Roland Music, found at freemusicarchive.org, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License.